I'm Dr. Neil Skolnick, Professor of Family and Community Medicine at the Sidney Kimmel Medical College of Thomas Jefferson University. Joining us today to discuss COVID-19 are three superb clinicians, Dr. Lena Wen, who is an ER physician and a public health professor at George Washington University. She previously served as Baltimore's health commissioner. She is the author of When Doctors Don't Listen. Her TED Talk on transparency in medicine has been viewed over 2 million times. And in 2019, Dr. Wen was named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. Dr. Susan Fidler, who serves as faculty in the Family Medicine Residency at Abington Jefferson Health and is an assistant professor of Family and Community Medicine at the Sidney Kimmel Medical College of Thomas Jefferson University. She's in charge of the boots on the ground response to the COVID epidemic in our office in Montgomery County, a small county that until recently accounted for half of all the cases of COVID-19 in Pennsylvania. And last but not least, Aaron Sutton, a licensed clinical social worker who serves as the behavioral health consultant for the Family Medicine Residency at Abington Jefferson Health and is in charge of the wellness program for clinicians across specialties at Abington Jefferson Health. I want to now go on to talk to Aaron Sutton about what I think is a critical issue in our ongoing ability to fight this pandemic. And in fact, Aaron and I wrote an editorial, both Lena's op-ed and our guest editorial, which is going to be published in Journal of Family Practice, are in your toolbox that you can download at the end of this presentation. We recently wrote a guest editorial about the importance of us as clinicians caring for ourselves while we care for others. That's a critical issue because this is not something that's going to be going on for a week or two. We're in it for the long haul, and if we can't sustain our health and energies, we won't be able to sustain our ability to care for others. Aaron, the military uses the term operational tempo. Can you describe for us from your experience in the military what that is and its relevance to our current situation?
Sure. Thanks, Neil. We use that definition to describe the speed and intensity of our actions in comparison to the environment that we're in. And so as we've all mentioned today, the environment's changed so much over the last 3 weeks. And as you just mentioned, we don't know how long this is going to sustain for and what to look for. We try to use that definition as a proactive measure, right? We try to gauge on how the operational tempo is going to change and how we can sustain it for the long haul.
That's excellent. And it seems to me that if we think about a practical approach to clinician wellness in this circumstance, we can think about it in a manner that is operationalizable as divided into three domains: physical, mental, and social, emotional. Can you give us some advice about each of those areas?
Sure. So why don't we talk about the physical aspect first? And you know, one of the first social places to close were gyms. And a lot of healthcare providers, you and I included, Neil, love to exercise, and we know the benefits and importance of it. So in trying to keep up with our schedules and our structure right now, we don't have that gym to rely on. So lots of places are offering virtual classes, virtual programs, Zoom gatherings of folks exercising so we can continue to maintain that exercise because we're going to need that to help us sustain again in the long haul. And nutrition, right? So we're not going out to eat, of course, practicing social distancing. We don't go out and have meals as we normally do. Lots of folks are cooking at home, which is great. But we have to make sure that we're not, if we're at home for long, extended periods of time, such as in quarantine, that we're not snacking and that we continue to have healthy options. So that's really the physical piece of it, that nutrition and exercise. And then for the mental piece, this is really taking a mental toll on us already, and we have a long ways to go. I've heard fellow colleagues discuss journaling during this time, and how important it is for them to notate and document how important it is for their mission that they're on, and they hope to look back on it and reflect one day. Also, if we're at home, I encourage folks, again, if they're not working at the hospital, perhaps they're on a week off, week on shift, or if they're in quarantine, to engage in some activities they find pleasure and accomplishment in, such as playing a musical instrument. Reading and writing during this time is also very beneficial. So trying to stay mentally on top of things to make sure that we don't fall into a state of depression or anxiety based off of these events. And then lastly, that social piece, right? So we're social distancing, as we all know. And you and I have said this week that social distancing doesn't have to mean social isolation, right? We're fortunate right now to live in a time where we can reach out to folks via technologies such as Skype or FaceTime. So it's important to make sure that we continue to reach out to family, friends, colleagues, people we may know from past experiences to see how they are doing during this time, to make sure that we have those engagements. So again, that physical, mental, and that social piece.
That's really helpful, Aaron. Thank you. And again, I think this is a critical area for us all to pay attention. So we're there for our patients, for our families during the long haul. We're now going to go over some questions. We have a lot of questions that have been coming in. There's a few questions on use of face masks in the outpatient setting. It's easy when you're part of a large healthcare institution or organization because those recommendations come from the top and we all do them. Many of us are not part of those large health systems. And a few people asked, what are the recommendations for whether we should be wearing a face mask with every single patient that we're seeing in an outpatient setting? Dr. Fidler, can I ask you to address that?
Sure, happy to. So I think the first part that we need to consider is trying to keep as many patients out of our office as possible, right? So if we're really trying to encourage social distancing, we should really be converting our offices to more telehealth and telephone-based medicine services. So trying to keep those who can stay out of the office, out of the office. My personal opinion is similar to, what Dr. Nguyen had mentioned before, is the face masks are to protect our patients from us, right? So I think that it is very likely that there are asymptomatic carriers amongst healthcare workers. And so wearing a face mask in the outpatient setting to help to protect our patients from us, I think, becomes very important. Again, I also think we need to consider not having sick patients and well patients around each other in our office. Our institution, we're fortunate enough to have a separate site where respiratory sick patients can go to. But for some way, even in smaller locations, to at least create an afternoon that sick patients are seen and a morning where well patients are seen. And again, trying to just protect everyone from everybody else becomes really important. So I would say, yes, we should be wearing a mask when we see patients in the outpatient setting as well.
I think that's really helpful. And Sue, I really like the way that you approach this, which is thinking about things ahead of time and trying to organize our system in a manner that keeps us out of making a decision each time we're walking into a room, keeping patients out as much as possible. We haven't talked today about telehealth, but I think many of us have been using telehealth as a incredibly useful way of continuing to give ongoing care for many of our patients who continue to need care, our patients with CHF, with diabetes, with COPD, where if we are asking them to stay at home, it would not make sense to ask them also to come into the office, so that the utilization of telehealth has suddenly created an opportunity around the country for us to interact with our patients in very meaningful ways and continue their ongoing care of their chronic diseases. Even simple things, we're doing in our office, if someone has an appointment where they do need to be seen, they can wait in their car until it's time for their visit and we can call them into the office. So all those approaches, Sue, that you allude to with organizing things ahead of time are so helpful. A few people have asked about the controversy over aces or ARBs. About 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was this question, should you withdraw aces and ARBs from everyone? Again, Sue, I'll ask you if you don't mind addressing that question.
I think the short answer is no. So folks who are on ACEs and ARBs are on them for very good reasons. And especially in our heart failure patients and our post-MI patients, I think that this is, again, where the data is just not there. As quickly as we're learning about things is as quickly as we are debunking some of these thoughts. So the current thought is that patients who are on ACEs and ARBs should stay on their ACEs and ARBs, because again, there's good reasons they're on them, and we want to protect them from a cardiovascular standpoint as well.
There are a number of questions about personal protective equipment, and that question of why is there an issue with having enough of it? Dr. Wen, can I ask you to address that?
Yes. Well, first of all, I just want to say that it is completely unacceptable that we're even having this conversation. I mean, I look back at what was happening in China at the end of January. And our collective gasp when we thought about nurses who are having to wipe down their single-use masks and use them for days, and doctors who are cutting out garbage bags, arms from garbage bags, to try to make their own gowns. And we thought, oh, that's so terrible. I mean, if doctors and nurses and healthcare workers are not protected, they'll be potentially spreading, as Dr. Fidler well mentioned, they could be spreading COVID-19 to their patients, much less what is the ethical responsibility that we have to provide for those on the front line. So I can't believe that we're even having these conversations. But so why is this occurring? Well, part of the reason is we are just not prepared as a country for a pandemic like this. We are prepared for events that are distinct individual events affecting one area of the country, as in we prepare for a hurricane, understanding that if one area becomes overwhelmed, staff and supplies can come from other areas. But what happens if there is a pandemic that is not a one-time event in one area, but is all over, and also is not a time-limited event, but is a marathon? And that's the problem that we're having, that even by the federal government's own estimates, well before COVID-19 even happened, we as a country are not prepared for an outbreak that's even considered to be a moderate outbreak, much less a severe pandemic. So part of the issue is that we have this big, big problem with preparedness. And I think that goes back to the lack of attention to public health, that we don't talk about public health and the need for public health until something bad has happened and this issue rises to the forefront. That is just what's already happened. What I have trouble understanding now is why are we still in the situation? Because we now realize how critical the shortage is of PPE around the country. It would be great to now see a national mobilization. You can't have states, as currently is the case, bidding against each other. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make sense that states have to come up with their own plans. States should come up with their own estimates for how much they need. But the federal government should now be procuring these supplies, especially given the supply chain issues that are happening around the world. The federal government needs to step in, really make use of the Defense Production Act, make use of its purchasing power as one unit instead of each state and maybe even hospital systems bidding against each other. So that's what needs to happen. And I hope that all of us can join in talking about why this issue is so important, because again, we can't build healthcare workers. And I just find it unconscionable that we would even be in the situation to begin with.
I couldn't agree with you more, and you say it so clear and well. We have a couple of, I think, very tough questions, and I'm gonna take the liberty of asking them because we're being asked them, our audience is being asked them as clinicians, and one has to do with this issue of droplet versus aerosol contagiousness. And we had a few months, 2 months ago, 1 month ago, heard that it is only transmitted by droplet transmission. And I guess there was an article, if I recall, it was in the New England Journal, our listener asked about being asked by patients about, can I do things like walk into a room where someone else was at recently or an elevator where someone was at? Am I worried about the particles remaining in the air for a long period of time? Dr. Wen, do you mind addressing that tough question?
I'll start, but I would also love to hear the input that you have, and Dr. Fidler and Erin and whoever else wants to jump in. You know, there is a lot that we know about COVID-19 and a lot that we don't know. And there is also, as everyone on this listening or viewing would know, there is an issue of relative risk. And I think it's important to talk about that relative risk. We know that the chance of someone becoming ill from COVID-19 is highest when it is an individual who is living with somebody and has close contact with somebody who has COVID-19. Certainly a healthcare worker who is being exposed because they're intubating patients or is exposed to a lot of patients, certainly that adds to their likelihood of exposure also. Your likelihood of exposure with casual contact with somebody is pretty low as an everyday person. And your likelihood of exposure, even if, and I'm not saying that we know this for certain, but even if there is some element of these respiratory droplets that somehow remain aerosolized, even if that's true, your likelihood of getting COVID-19 through that kind of casual contact is so low that I don't think based on what we know so far, I don't think that's what we should spend our time worrying about. The same thing with all those individuals who are worried about getting takeout food and going to the grocery store because they're worried about touching something. I mean, yes, we should think about those as potential risks, but know that those risks are just lower than getting into a crowded elevator and there are a lot of people around you. That risk is certainly higher than getting into an empty elevator where somebody may have been there 20 minutes ago. That's my view on this, but again, would love to hear what others.
Sure. I strongly agree with the way that you framed it. And Erin, I'm going to ask you about this in a minute, because I know this is an area, how patients perceive risk, that you and I have talked about and you work with patients a lot. But I think that's the core issue. We have to make sure that when we talk to patients that we don't only focus on the possibility of infection, but also on the probability. We can't eliminate risk in life. There is a lot of ambient risk, whether it's before COVID, there are car accidents, coronary artery disease, cancer. We walk out the door every day, and when we get home at night, we're thankful, but we don't think about it. We want to address this in a very serious way and diminish our risk. And Alina, as you said, a study that shows that in an air chamber, when particles are moved through a mechanical device, that there are some particles still in the air chamber, it doesn't mean that an empty elevator becomes a high-risk area. It is a much lower risk than if you're near someone. Erin, can you talk a little bit about how you go over with patients and with us as clinicians that idea of putting risk in perspective?
Sure, Neil, and I think you said clinicians as well, and I think it's important to think about the risk that we take every day going into an environment where we may potentially become infected and then bring that home to our loved ones. And my advice to everyone is to have that individualized approach to see what value is important to them. I've had a colleague recently who had a discussion with her husband about living separately during this time, and we agreed that it was to reduce their anxiety about bringing the virus home, which is a tough decision, but we had to look at the probability there and the risk and the value associated with it. So again, for patients, you know, who may be deciding on whether to go to see a neighbor or to see a family member, that risk there is probably high, right? So the probability that they may catch it or again, pass it to somebody may be high. So we need to look at an individualized problem-solving approach to it.
That's a great point. And my advice often to patients who are older with multiple comorbidities, is very different than to the 20-year-old who's saying, can I deliver food to elderly people in my neighborhood, where that's coming from the heart and the risk to that 20-year-old is low and providing such a benefit for those older people. Dr. Fidler, can I ask you our last question? We're about out of time, but it actually, what Aaron just said a few minutes ago is very similar to what one of the members of our audience asked. And that person said, if you are a healthcare worker, how should you approach the idea of re-entering your house at the end of the day? Should you think about decontamination? And if so, how?
Sure. I don't know that there's very specific guidance on this, but there are a lot of different things that have been offered up. And some suggestions that you could certainly consider. I will say that our office has changed to scrubs. I never would round in the inpatient setting in scrubs either, but have also changed to scrubs for ease of use. I think, you know, changing your clothing prior to coming home. I think showering when you get home is very reasonable. I think trying to, while you're at work, be very conscious of hand hygiene, touching your face, all of those things. And when you come home to your family, again, taking that moment to change clothes, to clean up, either wash up very well or take a shower prior to interacting with your family again.
Thank you so much, Sue. Lena, Aaron, Sue, thank you all for what has been a very, very productive overview of where we are at from a public health point of view, from a clinical point of view, from a self-care point of view. Hello, I'm Dr. Neil Skolnick, Professor of Family and Community Medicine at